Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. This week we talk about a little bit of everything. We've got two men from Iraq. One became a U.S. military translator and a citizen, but ultimately declared his loyalty to ISIS. The second man immigrated here to escape violence in his own country, only to be murdered as he filmed his first ever snowfall. We'll also talk about District Attorney Susan Hawke, who has for a second time checked herself into a clinic for treatment for severe depression. Joining me in the studio today are federal courts reporter Kevin Krause.
Good morning.
And political writer Gromer Jeffers.
Hello.
Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto ends the show in our usual way with his latest Hashing It Out. This time he talks about the scandal at Baylor and how the university handled sexual assault convictions and allegations against members of its football team. This week, a judge sentenced a U.S. citizen who was born in Iraq to 4 years in federal prison after the man declared his loyalty to ISIS. This wasn't just any guy. He had worked for the Army as a translator. Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about what this guy did and who he is?
Sure. He's an Iraqi born. He was born in Iraq, and he became a translator when the U.S. troops arrived during the first Gulf War. He testified yesterday that he was helping the troops. Like, for example, he told them where some weapons were stored in some schools. So the military decided to hire him as a translator because he speaks Arabic. Anyway, he was able to take advantage of this rare opportunity to become a U.S. citizen because of his work for the military. Comes over here in Texas, gets established, has an apartment, a wife, a child, and strangely wants to go to Syria to fight in the troubles there.
Wow.
Yeah. The FBI actually thought about cultivating him as an informant to let them know what was going on over there, and they looked into him a little bit more. The guy never told the same story twice. He was very unreliable, and he's kind of an odd fellow, I have to say. Seeing him in court there, he's not what you would think of as, you know, someone who is ready to wage jihad on the U.S.
So ISIS beat the U.S. to the punch then.
Yeah, so apparently so. we lost him to ISIS. But yeah, so what all this is going on, you know, he's going over there to fight for the Free Syrian Army, allegedly. And then out of the blue, he posts something on Twitter, basically pledging allegiance to the leader of ISIS.
And so that's how he was discovered. He was flying under the radar until he tweets.
Yes, he tweets, and the FBI goes, and they're like, whoa, what's going on here? We need to talk to this guy. So they did, and that's when he lied. He said that he did not pledge allegiance to ISIS, and so the FBI got a search warrant, searched his computers, found that he had. Also, he denied going to Syria to fight over there. He said he was actually traveling. Well, what happened was he tried to fly to Syria, but he was on the no-fly list. So he tried twice, two different airports, was stopped at the airport. Then he snuck in through Mexico. He took a bus to Mexico and then, I believe, caught a flight to Turkey and then from Turkey to Syria. And so he lied about that to the FBI. That's how they got him. Usually lying to the FBI is the last ditch charge that's available. They couldn't prove he was a terrorist. There's no indication that he was plotting anything. He seems kind of hapless, kind of an odd individual, as the judge noted. So they got him online to the FBI.
And so it really isn't, the crime isn't that he said, I support ISIS. The
crime is
he lied to the FBI agents. And so that's why he's going to prison.
Exactly. Because, you know, anyone can support ISIS. You know, Gromer, you could if you want. I don't think you would.
Let's hope not.
Yeah.
I say, Gromer, you might want to get this out of the way and say, no, that's not.
For the record, Gromer is against ISIS.
Right,
okay.
But I got to tell you, it's amazing what ultimately gets you gets you a conviction. You know, and Twitter, though, why? I guess he was. Yeah. You said he's kind of odd. I mean, pretty much telling the world, including the FBI, if you pledge allegiance on Twitter, right? And it's not.
Right. And that was his actual, that was one of his defenses was, look, if I was really, you know, wanting to, you know, fight for ISIS, why would I post it on Twitter? And he said the actual reason for doing this was he's Sunni. And, you know, there's the Shia and the Sunni right. have a long time, you know, war, a tribal war dating back centuries. And so he said he posted this to piss off the Shia. Because there's these Arabic websites where the two sides are going at it constantly, insulting each other.
Did he post this in Arabic or did he post in English? Do you know?
I believe it was in English. Yeah, yeah. And he says he just copied and pasted someone else's post.
Do we know what happened to that person?
Well, I mean, probably nothing if they didn't lie to the FBI.
No, that's true.
But, you know, the judge, I mean, his attorney, when this first came out, everyone was like, oh, my God, you know, we have an ISIS fighter living amongst us. But as more of the details came out in the sentencing hearing, we learned that this guy is a bit of a strange fellow who kind of, who can't tell the truth about anything. Got mixed up in something probably that, you know, he was in way over his head with. And the judge saw through it, or the judge apparently agreed with the defense attorney, said, no, this guy is not a terrorist. I don't think he's going to act on anything. But, you know, lying to the FBI is a serious offense. He did get 4 years in prison.
Wow.
You know, yeah.
What did Judge Kincaid actually say about this guy in court? Usually you get something stern from the judge, but it seemed not that it was a lighthearted moment, but it was, what did he call this guy? Do you remember?
He called him an oddball, or a goofball, I believe. An odd fellow and a goofball. And then at the end, after the sentence, he said, don't be stupid. That was his advice.
You mean after... He gets out.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly.
Wow. Exactly. He was on a no-fly list.
He was, so, yeah.
What landed him on that? Do you know? Or were they looking at this guy prior to his pledge of allegiance?
They must have been, because what happened was, when he got citizenship here, he joined the U.S. Army.
Ah.
But he did not complete his full training. And he ended up getting a general discharge, not a dishonorable discharge, but a general discharge. But that's not as high as an honorable discharge. So anyway, he was probably on the radar because maybe he'd been posting other things online and then, you know, suddenly leaving military service. And, you know, the FBI is, you know, they do have a tough job. They have to try to identify possible threats. And so, you know, this individual was working for the U.S. military in Iraq. And the government pointed this out, that he had access to a lot of, military operations and kind of inside information.
Kevin, I got to tell you, when Donald Trump hears about this, when he reads your story, look out, man.
Well, I hope he does read it, actually. That could get us a little publicity.
So this, I mean,
maybe he was retweeted you and you don't even know.
There you go.
He sounds pretty well connected. And
Donald Trump or the...
Well, yeah. I mean, to have a goofball or oddball, whatever he's called, I mean, to be in the military like this, that's kind of... Is that unusual? I would assume it is unusual, but
well, you know,
kind of scary to some people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, he at the time they probably thought this guy could be an asset because he was for a while. Like I guess as he was going through basic training, he was providing training to the U.S. He was providing training to the troops about how to deal with Iraqi culture and customs, you know, how to deal with, you know, women and over there, because these guys were, I'm sure, going to be deployed. You need to know that.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, the army, the U.S. armed forces like to have people of Middle Eastern descent, just to be.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, to be diverse, right. And then, right. And also because, you know, this guy spoke Arabic, and yeah. You know, he kind of knew how things happened over there. And
oddly, this is in contrast to another Iraqi man who his case was in court this week, but he was a murder victim. He came to the United States to escape the violence in Iraq.
That's a horrible
and
story.
It is horrible, and he goes outside in Dallas, and he, remember we got that big snowfall? He was filming the first time he'd ever seen snow,
right.
And you know, he's there with his family, and he's gunned down, he's killed, and his wife is trying to, you know, stop the bleeding and do whatever she can, and he'd just been here, he hadn't been here that long, and he was, you know, a victim of violence. At first they thought maybe he was targeted because he was an immigrant, but it looks like it was just a gangbanger who was firing a gun, and he was an unfortunate victim of that. And the killer, who was 18 years old when he did this, got 38 years this year, or this week.
Yeah, that's a really, really tragic and terrible story.
Well, and it's ironic that, I mean, he survived, you know, living in Iraq.
Oh, right.
Comes over here and
a random
gunned down.
Senseless shooting.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
So...
Streets of North Texas worse than what he experienced at home, ultimately.
Than a war zone at home, yeah. So do we know, I mean, obviously there was robbery wasn't the motive. Did this Nealon, I guess is his name, did he purposely shoot him, or was he just shooting his gun and accidentally hit him?
He wasn't firing at Ahmed. He wasn't trying to kill him. He there was something that had happened, you know, with the guy's girlfriend, and it was just senseless. I mean, not right. that any violence like that would make sense, but he wasn't aiming at Ahmed.
He was shooting his gun
5 feet over,
right.
or far less than that, you know, it wouldn't have hit him.
Right.
And it was just a horrible tragedy.
It was at the very end of July, and I had let things, my depression and my anxiety had gotten out of control. And I didn't even realize what it was. All I know that it had gotten to a place for me that I knew I didn't want to do this anymore. I knew I didn't want to be here anymore. I've thought enough about my job, and my job has always been such a big part of me, that I wanted to do the right way for there. And so, I thought I'll resign. And then I'll kill myself. And that was, then it was a feeling of peace that came over me. Like there was a solution.
That was Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk after she returned last year from 2 months in a clinic in Houston for treatment for severe depression, anxiety, and attention deficit disorder. Susan Hawk is back again seeking medical treatment in the same clinic she checked herself in on Friday. Her office said just recently, after days of not really knowing anything, that Susan returned from a 2-week vacation, really wasn't feeling right, wasn't feeling well, went to her doctors here, and then ultimately on Friday decided she needed to go back to the clinic.
It's interesting because it shows you that, one, that she's sort of a ways from being well. And this is probably going to be, well, it is going to be something that she's going to have to manage for the rest of her life. And what will be interesting is how her illness plays into her role as district attorney. And Jennifer and Kevin, you both know this, that really climate, that it can be a real hostile climate in a courthouse, how she navigates all of that. Because this, and we talked about this with her, the first go around, you know, being over there in a courthouse, that is a difficult job. It's one of the most challenging political jobs, you know, in North Texas, unless you like it. I mean, some folks like it. I mean, it's not that challenging at all, but it is. It's a tough job. And so I think what people are wondering is how she navigates that, but still does what she has to do to get herself well. And what we're probably seeing is a new normal. I mean, this won't be the second time she goes in for treatment. she's probably going to have to do it again. And we'll see how that impacts not only how she does her job, but where she goes, like in the future, how long she holds it, if she holds it, all of that stuff.
With most district attorney's offices in big metro areas like Dallas County, like Harris County, the first assistant usually runs the show anyway, right. And that is what Messina Madsen is doing now. She's running the show. And the district attorney in those instances is the big picture, provides, this is the big idea of what I want to get done. It is your job as the first assistant to carry it out. But now you have Messina Madsen, who is not the elected DA, trying to both carry out what right. needs to be done, but also having to see the big picture. And I know she has that input from Susan Hawk initially, but there's not that daily interaction where you go back and you make decisions, or you
right.
people who are advising the district attorney to make, you know, what decisions need to be made. I mean, Susan Hawk is ultimately the person who decides, do we seek or do we not seek the death penalty?
Right.
And, you know, that is, you know, the life or death decision that she's making in regard to people's lives. But there are many important decisions that have to be made.
Yeah, and you've written about other sort of decisions off the, you know, does this guy go to jail or not, decisions like forfeiture funds or, you know, in tech, exonerations units and things like that, you know, civil rights units, all these decisions that have to be made by, you know, I like to use the law and order example. You know, you have Fred Thompson who's back in the back and making the big decisions, and you wake him up when there's time for a press conference.
Although maybe the better comparison are the later episodes where it was Diane Weiss, since
right.
we have Susan Hawk,
exactly.
you know, Todd Fred
right.
Thompson, old school.
Old school, right.
Yeah, and although Law and Order is completely old school,
that's
now.
That's true now, I mean,
yeah.
But
there's still one on the air, SVU, right?
Right,
yeah,
which is a pretty good show, by the way. But, but who sets the policy, right? Who puts forth the agenda? This is the bold vision that we want to follow. You know, we might have a situation where you're playing cops and robbers. You're putting the bad guys in jail. You're making the day-to-day decisions. But in terms of the big picture, you know, I really don't know. And it puts a lot of pressure on Ms. Madsen. I hear she's up for the challenge, but...
I've known Messina Madsen for several years. I started covering the courthouse back in 2007. And I was away covering something else when Susan Hawk first took office, and when she first, you know, disappeared and we didn't know where she was, and then she came
right,
forward and
yeah.
said, I've, you know, seeking treatment for severe depression. But Messina is a, you know, very calm person. I mean, things can be blowing up around you, and, you know, I get stressed out and, you know, agitated, and it shows. But, you know, Messina is very good about from what I've seen, and what from attorneys who've worked with her and who have trained her since she was a young prosecutor say, is that she's very good at deciding, you know what, this isn't a fire we have to put out right now. This can wait. And she's very good at prioritizing. And it's just, you
it's
know,
probably
how,
what they need right now, right?
And it's just, you know, how yeah. it's what they need. And she, yeah. she's a very calm presence.
Does she have any political aspirations of maybe taking over the office someday?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. She was promoted she was a supervisor, but she was promoted several times after Susan Hawk fired Bill Wersky in the office. And that was another problem.
Right.
Susan had accused Bill of breaking into her house and stealing a photograph, and it was very weird. And Bill is a very respected prosecutor, and he's now working in the Collin County DA's office. But it's so, you know, she later took it
right.
back, but you know, he was the person carrying out her ideas and, you know, running the office in the way that she wanted to, and he really had a gravitas, a great deal of experience that is very different from Messina's. Messina does not have the kind of experience that Bill had, but she's also that calm nature and that taking charge For now, that really seems to be what the office needs. And right now, we don't know when Susan Hawk will be back. She just went in on Friday. It's been almost a week. And, her doctors have to evaluate her. And, you know, maybe she already has a medical plan, but that hasn't been released.
So is anyone calling for her to step down or renewing calls?
There are rumblings of that.
Right. Not as great as before, but they're still, you know, what is it, Pete Schulte. Who's a candidate. Dallas lawyer.
Yeah, Tom Novak.
Who ran in against her in the primary in 2014.
Yes, and he says that he's not going to run again, but he has come out and said, you know, Susan Hawk needs to resign. It's what's best for the office. And there are people who support her, George Milner. There's a lot of people who want more information, and there's not really a lot of information right now.
But there
was a lawsuit filed last time to try to remove her from office, and that failed. And so, you know, we've been down that road, and the courthouse has been down that road. So ultimately, unless there's some new information, it seems that, you know, there are rumblings, but this is still very new, and we really don't know what's to come.
And it doesn't look like the Dallas County Commissioner's Court is going to say anything or get involved in this situation. And Kevin, you covered the Commissioner's Court during some wild and woolly days.
Oh, yeah.
I'm interested to get your take. If this was occurred during back in your era of covering county the commissioner's court, and something like this happened, do you think it would be this quiet? Or
it's a very good question. When her predecessor Craig Watkins was in office, the big question was competency and politics. You know, was Craig playing politics with the office?
And there were accusations that he was misusing the office to go after both Republicans and Democrats in his own party, and having grand jury proceedings and trying to get an indictment against several sitting judges and against a Republican county commissioner. And Craig Watkins is a Democrat. Susan Hawk is a Republican. We should put that out there.
Right.
And now this is a very different situation because it involves mental illness.
It's
very kind of a sensitive topic. And if someone had DA was receiving cancer treatments, you know, you wouldn't say they should resign. So I think given that, the commissioner's court back then would have been as harsh toward Susan as they were toward Craig.
So it probably will be the same then, and see. Yeah. You know, what's tough about this situation for a lot of people is, you're right, I mean, if she had some other sort of illness, you know, there would be, you know, let's pray for Susan. There still is now.
Although there's also been some talk about, you know, can she do the job?
Exactly.
That if someone had cancer, And either the cancer or the treatment had an impact on their mental acuity, on their mental abilities.
Yes.
Many people have said who believe Susan should resign have said, you know, the district attorney job is all about mental acuity. It is all about how you use your brain, and it's a high stress situation. And I did also, at the heart of all this, people on both sides, people who want Susan to resign, people who say Susan should stay, and how dare you say she should resign, everybody wishes her the best. They want her to get well. And there are some people who think she can get well and remain in office.
Sure. Mental illness is treatable.
And there
she's seeking treatment.
Right, and she's seeking treatment. And there are people who think the best way for Susan to be healthy is to not have the pressures of the district attorney's office. As you talked about, Grummer, it's a very high-stress job, both because it can be life and death, and just the criminal justice side, but there's also the political side.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. And, you know, to be quite frank, the only person that has the correct answer for this is Susan Hawk, right? I mean, she knows whether, well, you would think that she would know whether she can do this job or not. She says she can. But ultimately, you know, it's going to be her decision whether she goes forward, because she's an elected official. You're right, Jen. The move to oust her from office has already took place and failed. So, you know, when she comes back, it's going to be, hey, you know, D.A. Hall, can you do the job? And we'll wait for her answer. She'll probably say, yes, I can, and move forward. And we won't know until the 2018 election whether voters, you know, give her another 4 years or not. But we may be essentially, and I don't want to use the word stuck, but we'll be with her in her decision for the rest of her term, you know, whatever she decides to do.
Right. And if there's turmoil in the office, it'll get out.
And right, exactly. We'll learn about it, so. And that's, you know what, and let me say this. A lot of what Susan Hawk's problem was in the past was not necessarily about the illness. Jennifer brought some of this up earlier, you know, the Bill Worski situation. You know, Hawk said that had nothing to do with the severe depression, right? I mean, that's sort of different. I think people want to know a couple of things. One, you know, we don't want that sort of episode again in the DA's office. That was really different and wild and outrageous. And also the transparency issues, the deception and the lying and things like that. This doesn't seem like the second time around, that doesn't seem to be an issue, right? At least
yes.
That we know of. So I think if she can clean some of that stuff up, and it appears that maybe she has, that'll go a long way of building back confidence that some folks, you know, lack with that office now. Because it was all about that episode, you know.
That's all for us today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Read more about the stories we talked about today on DallasNews.com. And remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel. For Kevin Krause and Grummer Jeffers, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now, we drop the mic.
Our weekly topic is supposed to be crime, so why worry about Baylor University and its nationally prominent football program? Two reasons, one literal, one logical. According to reports, including the police type, five Baylor football players since 2009 have been accused of at least 8 incidents of sexual violence against female students. By any standard, a disturbing trend. Ken Starr, the Bill Clinton prosecutor, could not remain as university president, in part because of Baylor's indifferent response to such complaints against scholarship football players. But if Starr is responsible for everything that happens at Baylor, and he is, who was in charge of those athletes? If you understand big-time college sports, it's implausible that a coach as successful as Art Briles, one, had no idea, or two, was powerless to fix this. No single human in Waco, Texas is as powerful as a champion football coach. Yes, his job was winning football games, not Title IX compliance. But at a university with Baylor's high moral and ethical standards, seeking both is not unreasonable. Art Briles turned Baylor's football fortunes, but at what cost? If Starr must go, and he must, Briles had to go too. Anything less would have been worse than hypocrisy. It would have been dangerous to Baylor women and, yes, a crime.